You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and it gives me enormous pleasure to bring to you today the interdimensional ABK, which is to say the stand-up comedian and kind of creative genius that is Alistair Beckett King. I am a huge fan of Alistair's work. I saw him in Edinburgh back when it existed. And also, I tell you what, if you were listening to the first few minutes of this and are undecided and thinking, oh, am I going to dig this guy? I highly recommend you follow the link on the show notes, which I have called That Incredible Trailer. And you will see a 2-minute trailer in the style of kind of Ulysses and Thundercats and shows like that from the 80s, in which he created entirely himself using the animating techniques of those shows. It's one of the best individual things I think I've ever seen a comic produce. And if you fancy getting into the mind of someone who produces that, or indeed if just simply how excited I am about it, and my voice now makes you think I won't bother watching it, I'll watch it after. If neither of those things are true, then please continue to listen. This is an excellent interview with an excellent performer, and there are 20 minutes of extra content available for you, including Alistair talking about scripting video games, and he gives a brilliant example of using jokes as a means of hiding internal mechanics in the games. And we also talk about why people think he dies a lot more often than he does. He's a very robust comic, but he looks like an arty wimp. So we'll talk about that in the Insiders Club. Go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders for that and much more, all of the extra stuff from every episode that has it. And thank you to you if you have recently signed up to the Insiders Club. A couple of people have jumped in the last week, and it's great to have you on board. All that being said, pin back your ears, drag some sort of ancient narwhal tusk comb through your barnet, and enjoy this interview with Alistair Beckett King. So, welcome to the show, Alistair Beckett King, or ABK, which is, it must be so nice to have such a neat set of initials that are uniquely identifiable.
I'm glad you think that that's a good feature. I remember being told by I'm already thinking, can I say things that you're going to cut? I was about to say Hills Jago. I can talk about Hills Jago?
You can talk about Hills Jago.
I remember Hills Jago saying, you can't have a long name. How's that going to fit on billboards? And it hasn't been a problem thus far, probably specifically because of the length of the name. I don't remember anyone telling Ramesh his name was too long, but I've abbreviated it to ABK occasionally.
And when I think of ABK, the first thing I think of is the interdimensional ABK, which I have to say, well, let's start with that because... Well, should we start with that? I don't want to sort of give people the impression that you are solely an animator. I tell you what, we'll start with the most
I'm scarcely an animator.
The most recent time I saw you was at Chops Comedy Club online on my Twitch channel, which I'm not going to mention here. It'll be in the show notes. People can find it. But you just knocked it out of the park. I knew that what you did would go down well. You'd done the Infinite Sofa a couple of times, so you were familiar with the kind of the tone of the room,
yep,
in inverted commas. So I knew you were going to do well because I knew that what you would do, in short, I knew that what you do
would really appeal to my nerds, right?
Yeah. Now, I mean, there are a lot of nerds in that room, let's be honest.
There's a few nerds
what
there.
A bunch of nerds.
And I've seen you live at Edinburgh a couple of times, and you enormously appealed to my inner nerd. Your take on comedy, such as it has become over the last few years since I first gigged with you and maybe the Camden Head some time ago, you seem to me to have really grown into this identity as, if not always the interdimensional ABK, but an eccentric outsider who has kind of tones of Doctor Who, but who has, like, your take on comedy is so erudite and wordy and inventive and imaginative that I just knew it was going to play well. And it did. There were three or four. I don't know how much of the gallery view you had on during that show.
I couldn't see them at all.
People were crying, laughing. There was one person, Ali, who was crying, I would say, for 20 minutes. Who she was on one of those kind of juggle combo rolling laughs that she couldn't get her breath. It was fantastic.
Well, that's so lovely. But the context of that is that that's an excessively supportive room and by no means representative of what my previews are normally like.
That was fair.
Very much a too supportive, too nice room.
Yes, false positives, left, right and centre.
I haven't done a preview for like 6 months.
Sure, sure. And you were very nervous going into it as well, weren't
you? I was extremely nervous going into it. I mean, I was extremely nervous coming into this because it feels like a job interview for a job that I already have, except that I don't do it at the moment. Well, it's very weird.
If you fuck up ComCom Pod, you get sacked from ComCom.
Yeah, I mean, I had always suspected that I was a comedian and there was never any proof. But now I'm on this, I have a chance to demonstrate that I am a comedian. But there's so much at stake here.
What do you think of that my rendition of how I see you? Is that how you see yourself?
Yeah, eccentric outsider. That's what I'm going for. That's what I always wanted. I don't know if that's what I am, but it's what I always wanted to be. I didn't want to be from. I grew up in the northeast of England. I don't have a very strong regional accent because I specifically didn't want to get one when I was a kid because I didn't want to be from there. I didn't want to be from anywhere particularly. I wanted to be different. I didn't want to join in and do what everyone else was doing. It's quite pathetic, really.
No. Well, I mean, perhaps, but I mean, it's very relatable.
Worked out all right.
It's very
relatable.
Turned
it into a shtick.
Yeah, there we are. Talk to me about what everyone else was like then that you wanted to be so different from. You are, as for the benefit of the listener, you are a profoundly red-headed man.
I am. Like, yes.
So you were kind of inescapably different in one respect.
Yeah, although there's quite a lot of redheads in the northeast. It's like Scotland in that respect. But yeah, no, I've got long red hair, which I suppose I have to take some responsibility for having grown that. I could have cut it short, as is stylish in the northeast.
Let's say you've lent into your very red hair. Very, very red, and there is a lot of it, which is clearly a decision
at all.
Yeah, yeah. So what were you trying to be different from? I really relate to that. Like growing up in an environment where I thought this, whatever this is, it isn't for me. I want to be different and I'm going to bend the rest of my life to my will in that pursuit. I've got my own reasons for doing that. What were you being different from and why?
Well, I don't think it's about being different from. I think it's about not being part of the group for any reason at all. Like one of the things I hate the most is when everybody sings together or when everyone is dancing or if there's a bit in a comedy show where you have to join in. I hate being in the audience for that because I don't want to do that. I've seen it watching QI. There was one episode of it. All the panelists begin to sing a song and the camera cuts away quickly from Stephen Fry's face. And I completely identify with Stephen Fry because I can see how intensely uncomfortable he is with the fact that everybody else is singing because he will not and cannot join in. And for me, that was a delightful moment. You know, it's about seeing yourself represented, seeing his discomfort as everybody else sings. I recognize that completely. I don't want to join in. I don't want to be doing the thing everybody else is doing. I can't do it.
Are there any exceptions to that rule? I'm thinking, and I'm sort of guessing here, I may be wrong, I would imagine you enjoy I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue.
Yes, I've listened to it. I'm not a huge aficionado. But
I'm just thinking of moments in rooms when I have absolutely joined in. And it's with like the in-jokes in that, like the arrival of the lovely Samantha and everyone applauds for that. And it's kind of, that's a joining in joke. Right. Oh. So there are different types of joining in, right?
Yes, absolutely. No, that that is something that I like. And in my stuff, try to engineer stuff where essentially the premise of the show is, hey, I know this isn't true, but just play along. Just play along with this bit and it's going to go somewhere interesting. And yes, Samantha in that is a great example of that. And in the Interdimensional ABK show, I claim to be from another dimension. I'm obviously not. It isn't important that that isn't true. In fact, it's important that it's not true, but that we all just play along with it and go along with that being true because I've written jokes based on it.
Sure, sure, sure.
And if the audience buy into it, but still, that's them joining in that I enjoy more than me joining in.
I see. Okay. So what, and do you have any pet theories as to what that stems from? Was there some, were you kind of forced to join in a thing as a kid? Or was there a general sense of like school where there was pressure put on you that you resisted? Or is it simply that you kind of looked at the world around you and arrogantly thought,
yeah, it's that one.
I'll have none of this.
Yes. No, it's that one. I just looked at the world around me and it did not meet my high standards. And I said, no, not good enough for ABK. No, it is. I think it is the pathetic arrogance of youth that I've just carried through into adulthood.
And what kind of a youth were you? What was your family situation like when you were a kid? Have you got siblings? Who are you as a person outside of all this?
I'm just a regular human being. I've got a younger sister and a mum and a dad. And so I grew up in County Durham, and I'm middle class by Durham standards. Both my parents worked, and I talk like this. So I was very, very middle class. And then I moved to London and it turns out that I'm like lower middle class by London standards, because middle class in London is you have a pool and you know the Prime Minister. So it's very it's very weird to realise that my class position has shifted as I've geographically moved downwards. But yeah, I think ordinary. It felt very ordinary, the Northeast. And I now feel very nostalgic for it and how I don't live there. But there are things that I don't miss about it, like I, because I've got red hair, I spent most of my childhood and teenage years just being heckled in the street regularly, like on an hourly basis.
Which is one of those things that people think you're allowed to do, even now. You can just shout at a ginger.
Yeah, I don't know what it's not. It doesn't upset me particularly, you know. And I think there are people who sort of make spurious parallels with racism and other forms of prejudice, which aren't tenable, but it is annoying. And so I've developed a sort of tunnel vision, so people who are walking with me will sort of judge me and say, did you hear what that person said, or didn't you notice that person looking at you? And no, I never notice those things. I'm just in my own mind doing my own thing. I'm completely focused. I'm not very aware of what's going on around me because I'm not that interested most of the time.
When did that start? When did that kind of public heckling of your hair start?
When did the public humiliation begin? And how did you try and monetize it?
We might lazily draw a parallel between that and, you know, comedy and the comedian wanting to control the way in which you're laughed at, control the way people react to you.
Yeah. I know it's absolutely that. But the annoying thing was, you know, people would sort of heckle me. And I would sort of do a funny response, rolling with it.
Yeah.
I would sort of impro it, and then they would not get the joke, and so it wouldn't work. And that was very frustrating.
Yeah.
It's like casting pearls before swine. I don't know. I don't know if... Yeah, you're probably right. It's all quite pathetic, isn't it? A sort of adolescent arrogance that I have just spun into some jokes.
Well, I think adolescent arrogance that has been spun into some jokes could sum up quite a lot of comics. If not careers, then they're starting points.
Yeah, there is a whole genre of comedy which is, here's how that argument would have gone if I had won it.
Yes, there really is, isn't there? Ed Byrne is kind of the king of that genre, I would say. Yeah.
Yes, and it can be wonderful. And I've definitely got jokes that fall into that category. Or here was the one time I actually said something witty off the cuff. Presented as if I do that all the time.
I've tweaked all of the elements such that it's even wittier and I had even less chance to think of it.
Yes.
So something I noticed about your work is that it has a sort of willful, I wouldn't say obtuseness, but there is something willful about it in that I wonder whether you are calling out to other outsiders.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's one of the things I like about comedy. But I don't know. I don't know where my stuff stands, really, because you know, sometimes when if I do like a very clubby club with sort of weather-beaten, road-hardened acts, and do well, I'll get sort of a backhanded compliment from people. You know, the kind of people who've been sort of 30 years in the game will say something like, "Very brave of you to go out with such intelligent material." which I never know. Is that kindness or am I being undermined subtly?
Sure.
The thing is, though, I don't think my material is exceptionally intelligent. You don't need to know. Like, I make ref. I don't think it's that nerdy. Like, some people are good at maths. I can't do any maths. I think it might be a learning difficulty. I'm that bad at maths. And I don't think you need to know any of the references that are in my stuff to understand the punchlines. None of the punchlines hang on you knowing some obscure fact
that's
or detail.
Yes.
I don't make jokes. Like, Schrödinger's cat has somehow become a semi-mainstream joke idea in the last few years. But I still think it's too. I think that's too niche a concept to hang a punchline on without having explained. Because you can't guarantee. I would do a joke about that, except I think it's gone a bit. It's a bit overplayed.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's both a bit stale and a bit fresh.
So one for the nerds in Stu's little couch sofa lounge. I couldn't remember the name of your show there. Sorry,
that's fine.
The Infinite Sofa. That's what it's called. What was I saying?
So that you wouldn't hang a punchline off that because it depends on already knowing some information, and that isn't the sort of stuff you do.
Well, I don't want it to be just. I want there to be stuff in there for people who are into the same things I'm into. But I don't want that to be the punchline. Like, so I've got a bit about William Blake's Proverbs of Hell, classic pants. But you don't need to have heard of William Blake. None of the punchlines are riffs on William Blake's life and works, obviously, because in spite of being one of the greatest English writers and artists, he's not that famous. But the joke structure is just I read a bit of poetry and then I say something that I wrote that's stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very funny because my stupid things undermine the very good writing of William Blake. And that's the joke. It's not. Yeah. There's nothing intelligent about that. It's just sensible, silly, sensible, silly, sensible, silly. That's that. Why does that seem intelligent? Is it because of the way I talk? Is it because I'm reading it out of a book? I don't know.
It's weird, isn't it? I wonder. I'm just sort of visualizing a sort of chicken in a basket Saturday night club audience. Almost, I could imagine them bristling at the simple fact that the subtext of the joke is that you have read some William Blake and I haven't.
Well, you would think. I was never. You would think that bit doesn't work in clubs, but it does. It works really well. At least as consistently well as my act works in clubs, which is fairly well. Like, I think. Mm. I think people assume I'm dying all the time because it's because I'm just coming in with my sort of carefully woven whimsy. And I don't die that often. Like, people enjoy it. It is accessible.
Yes, there is something about there's something about the look of you. And I know you've got brilliant jokes about your appearance. And I remember
very
trying to persuade you. Very
accessible jokes about my appearance.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Very accessible. I remember trying to persuade you should do one about looking like a brass rubbing. But I think you've probably already done that.
Yeah, I think I did. Yeah, I might have done that.
But you have such a particular look and you make no... Even I wouldn't do a joke about the writings of William Blake. Predominantly because I haven't read any of the writings of William Blake, I'm ashamed to admit.
that's a big hurdle.
Big hurdle. But also I would worry, wrongly I think, I think to do a joke that refers even to William Blake, however sort of simply, and however much the punchline doesn't hang on previous knowledge, but I think in doing that you are sensibly playing to the highest intelligence in the audience. And I somehow shy away of that, and I think it's to my detriment, because I worry that, oh, what if I alienate people? But there is something about you and, for example, your long hair that sort of you don't seem... It's not that you don't care whether you alienate people. There is something uncompromising about your you-ness. Do you think?
Well, the goal for me, and the nice thing about when those kind of bits work, is there's two things. It's that it makes an audience feel clever, I think. When you do a clever joke, and they if an audience thinks, I'm not sure I'm going to get this, and then they do get the punchline, that's a nice feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes, it does, obviously it does have the unfortunate side effect of making me seem terribly clever and likable, which is purely accidental. But the main goal is the charitable one of making the audience feel clever, I think. Like, so I have an opening joke of mine, which I still do, because why would I stop? It's good. Is I compare my appearance to John the Baptist, and then I do a little mime where I make myself look like a famous painting of John the Baptist. And you don't know that you get that reference until I do the mime. You might not know John the Baptist specifically that well.
Okay.
But as soon as you see the mime, you go, oh yeah, I've seen that painting.
Okay.
And it gets a very good laugh. And part of that is people going, oh, yes, I do know what he's talking about. I do understand this. This seemed like it was a bit of obscure nonsense, but actually it's a joke I get. Isn't that extra fun? Isn't that extra nice?
And do you... Sorry, go on.
No, I was just saying, the other nice thing is, in a weekend club, you know, so I've got, you know, if I'm doing a 20 set, I've got... like 5 minutes at the start, which are all just jokes about my appearance. There's nothing terribly sophisticated about that. That John the Baptist joke is essentially I know what you're thinking.
Sure.
Here's someone I look like joke. I've just disguised it so it doesn't seem like it is. And what's nice is it's really, really nice sort of to have, you know, when there's a rowdy, poppy, as you say, chicken in the basket gig, 15 minutes later to be able to pull out a book and start talking about William Blake and have people be quiet in the bits where they need to be quiet because they want to hear what I'm going to say. It doesn't always work. I'm not arrogant or naive or unself-aware enough to think that I always get away with it. And I don't always get to leave the pauses because sometimes I realize I've just got to get to these lines, otherwise somebody's going to chip in with something. But a lot of the time, people are quiet because they're listening now. And that's really, really nice that I can make them be quiet as well as laugh when I want them to laugh.
Mm.
When I can do that, it's very, very nice.
So this is Alistair, a tremendous joy. It's one of those Hear It In My Voice episodes, loving talking to ABK, and we'll get right back to it after these messages. These messages in this case being that you should go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to hear more from ABK about his awful film school criticism experience and also scripting video games and also other things besides. Really difficult to make the decision about what to put the insiders in this because I wanted to leave it all in and I wanted to keep it all secret. So back to this in just a second. Thank you if you are one of the people who's responded to the soft launch of my comedyinsights.com website. Have a look in there. The link is in the show notes to find out what I can do to cheer up and energize your business people, your staff members, if you're the sort of person that has staff members. Here is something nice that a ComCom listener who then booked me to talk to his major FMCG company, and I don't know what FMCG means, this was from Matt, who said, we booked Stu to talk to our team about resilience, and the feedback from all attendees was incredibly positive. Stu's an engaging speaker who mixes humour with brilliant advice. His session sparked many thoughts and conversation points that we wouldn't normally discuss together as colleagues, and it encouraged people to open up as they considered implementing some of the techniques discussed to improve resilience. Isn't it a shame that the word discussed, when said out loud, can be heard as two different words? Thank you so much, Matt. Thanks for the opportunity. I enjoyed talking to your people enormously. And apologies to you, the casual listener, who does not have a business that can employ me, for making you sit through me reading out a nice description of what it is I do. I try never to do that about the podcast or indeed my comedy. But look, there's potentially life-sustaining income on the line here, so you will, and I'm telling you, you will forgive me if I briefly divert to talking about that. That's all the middle bit, though. If you want to communicate with me in some way, you can do that at ComComPod or indeed info@comedianscomedian.com. Sorry for the lateness of my replies, but I do reply to everything. Let's get back to the interdimensional ABK.
I was positing, I suppose, that your work is a kind of call to other outsiders, your work in comedy. And I suppose also I must confess that part of why I like it, if challenged, I will have to admit that it does make me feel clever for having got it. Because, you know what I mean? Let's be honest.
Yeah.
But some of the bits, one of the bits I remember really standing out from your show at Edinburgh 2019.
So that was my second hour.
That was only your second hour?
God. That was my second hour, yes. Very, very, very lazy. hardly written any shows.
The bit about numbers, which you then reprised on the chat show recently, the bit about numbers, if they contained as many, if the word for the number, the name of the number, contained as many letters as the number itself.
Yes, it annoys me very much that four has the same number of letters as four, but none of the others have the same number of letters.
Could you, just so we know what we're talking about here, I won't ask you to massacre the bit, but could you tell us the first few?
Yeah, well, to be fair, it won't really work in audio because you need to see them written down.
You need to see
in
them
a monotype
spelled.
Font,
yeah, that's true.
So
yes,
you can see a monospaced font, so you can see that they get longer with no kerning. But it's so 1 to 10 is oo, 2, 3, 4, good old 4, 5, six, 7, 8. 9. That one's just got loads of eyes. And Tendermank. It's very, very straightforward.
It is such a beautiful bit, and it speaks to, I don't know what, it speaks to something in me, which is kind of like, it made me feel like a kid. It made me feel like I'd watched episode one of Red Dwarf for the first time. Do you know what I mean? I kind of went, yeah, so oh, I like this sense of
Red
humour.
Dwarf fan.
I like this.
Yes.
Imagination. I like that it felt science fiction-y. I guess that's to do with the screen that it was on and the font and all the rest of it. And it just kind of, I watched it and I thought, here is a person who likes a lot of the same stuff I like, but has a better imagination than I do. And it was one of those moments. I mean, there was a lot of stuff like that in the show, but that was the one that particularly stands out. It was one of those shows that I came away from thinking, I will make an appointment to see everything this guy does.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's particularly nice because I think you saw either the worst or the second worst outing of that show.
Oh, come, ABK, we're better than that.
This is not false modesty. I think the one you were in, a school friend had come and sat on the front row and smiled supportively without laughing at any point in the entire show.
That would be murderous.
And so you very kindly brought two friends of yours.
Yes.
And I think the three of you, the reason you may have thought it was going well is that they were laughing either side of you, creating a stereo effect. But the rest of the room was silent and furious.
It was not silent and furious. It may not have been your best gig, but it was really good.
Very much. In fact, it was very nice that you were there because it's when you have one like that with a school friend who just thinks, wow, he's deluded. He can't do this.
Yes, of course.
How has he got to this point of having a run at Edinburgh if he can't do it? Not realizing that sometimes everyone can't do it sometimes. It just doesn't work sometimes.
How are you with that? How are you, just while we're on that, how is your kind of resilience? How is your ability to function during a show which, like, I sometimes, that thing, a person you went to school with smiling supportively would make my personality collapse in on itself. Or would, I mean, these days, obviously far less so. I'm kind of trying to get in touch with the most vulnerable parts of myself.
Yeah.
And as I very frequently do, being far too self-deprecating on this show, brackets, I am an excellent comedian. But but those things, like, to see that particularly a school friend, that strikes to the very core of the children who no longer exist that I'm somehow trying to impress. You know?
Yeah, no, it's exactly that. I was very nervous about talking to you on this because of my tendency towards being self-deprecating. I've talked myself out of gigs and opportunities by being what I thought was polite and English, and then realizing that people took me seriously and thought that I couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. So I just like to add the brackets that I also am good and accessible, and can do comedy. But yeah, I don't know whether I deserve to be a comedian because I don't have I've listened to this podcast. I didn't listen to it before I became a stand-up, but pretty soon after I started, somebody said, hey, you got to listen to this new podcast by young Stu Goldsmith. He doesn't have a child. And then 400 years passed and now we're in the present. And I'm losing my thread.
You were saying about the podcast, I think you were probably going to say something along the lines of people on this show often say that.
Yeah. So I'm aware that I ought to be struggling with sort of major mental health problems and borderline personality disorder or something like that. And as far as I'm aware, I don't think I'm even autistic. There's no evidence that I'm autistic. I just don't like making eye contact. It's a quirk. I don't want to use the phrase, I don't think there's anything wrong with me, because I don't want to stigmatize any of those things. But okay. I mean that in the best possible way. If you want your comedians to have something a bit askew about them. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I have that. I don't have serious childhood trauma. Mm-hmm. I made a real mistake because I was nervous about coming on the podcast, and then I listened to Janie Godley's podcast.
Yeah, sure.
You did. Yep. And if anyone is going to make you feel like you don't deserve... If anyone is simultaneously, innately, naturally funny and incredibly hardworking, mm-hmm. extraordinarily confident, which always intimidates me mm-hmm. because I'm not, but also massively generous. I find Janie to be extraordinary as well as a fantastic comedian, because that her kind of confidence, her kind of conviction that she's funny and she can do it, isn't often married to a generosity towards other performers and other people. And hers
is. Yeah, well said. Yeah.
Which I just think is fantastic. And so I read that and thought, yeah, I should just quit. I don't deserve to be a comedian. Comedy should just be Janie Godley and the rest of us should just go home. Which during lockdown, that is what's happened.
Yeah, fair.
So what I'm saying is I'm fine.
Yeah. What is it then with regard to coping with things when they go wrong? Coping with things when they go wrong in the minute, when jokes misfire or someone coughs over a punchline or a crucial pause or something, and also coping in the longer term when you are on the way home after a rough one. Mm. What's your toolkit for survival?
Well, mostly I just get sad in that situation. I think there's a lot of sort of spirits. I was about to try and say a French phrase in English. Esprit d'escalier. I was going to say spirit of the stairs.
Yeah.
Because I'm English. Yeah, there's a lot of, oh, if only I'd said that, or oh, if only I'd said this. The situation I don't know how to deal with, and the one that frustrates me, is if I'm fairly quick-witted. Like, I don't think I am. I'm a fairly serious person, I think, in general. I don't think I'm... My dad always used to say, oh, there's funny people, and there's people who say funny things. He doesn't really talk like Bernard Manning, but he's from Manchester, and so I just have to kind of try and differentiate. Otherwise, he's got the same voice as me, so I have to talk like that. He said, there's funny people, and there's people who say funny things. And so I was always sort of thought, oh, well, I don't think I am one of these funny bones, funny people. I think I can say funny things. But what's nice about doing comedy is you realise that actually that's quite important, and that there's loads of writers in comedy who aren't particularly funny but can write funny things, and you can make a living doing that, and it's good. And also, you know, listening to this podcast and meeting people, you realise, well, there's a fewer people who are really genuinely funny all the time, but there are. I don't know anybody who doesn't have to work at it, because you sort of imagine that if you can do it, you can just do it without trying. And I really appreciate learning that everyone has to try really hard. If you want to do it, you have to try really hard, even if you're quite good at it to begin with. And so that sort of reassures me. The thing I don't know how to deal with is if people just chat to the person next to them. That's mm-hmm. very hard for me to deal with. I was about to say in character, but in character as me, because I can't. Often people are really rude in that situation, but I can't be rude. If I attack the audience, people are like, why is he upset? What's going on? It's out of character for him to be upset. In that situation, I just become a sort of a weak substitute teacher trying to control a room, which is way worse than that not happening. So that is the... If you've said something to me and I can hear the words and I know what you've said, then I'm pretty good at dealing with that. But the ones where I kick myself are when there were just a sort of table of people who were just a susurration of disinterest, uninterest, I should say. Uninterest is the correct word. Disinterest is the wrong word. A susurration of boredom with what I'm doing. Because the thing with my jokes is you have to listen to them to get the punchlines.
Yeah.
And if you're not prepared to listen, you won't enjoy it. And that's when I find myself angry on the train home, or angry on the tube, something like that. And I don't know how to deal with that. Haven't solved it.
Let's talk a bit about the character. You've mentioned being in character on stage. What separates you from your on-stage persona? Or are you one and the same?
I'm just a lot less funny. Loads less funny in real life. More serious. I get angry and tetchy in real life about things. Like, things really annoy me. But I don't find... Some people are hilarious when they're angry. And some people's whole shtick is... You know, like, I don't know if Rod Gilbert is really that angry about torches. But he seems angry about torches and mince pies. And I don't know if that's true or not. But it's funny that he is so angry about those inconsequential things. But I don't think I am angry when I'm... I don't think I'm funny when I'm angry. I don't think I can do a funny rant. Whenever I've tried it, it hasn't worked. And so I don't do that. And I don't usually make political points because... For a similar reason, that it's sort of... I don't particularly enjoy people... Like, I've got some very witty observations about politics, but they're not really jokes. I don't know how to turn them into jokes. I know how to get them to the point that people who agree with them will applaud at them, but that doesn't seem enough. Mm-hmm. It seems like you have a really good political joke needs to go further than that. I'd rather just do yet another joke about ginger.
It's interesting. One of your one of the qualities I most readily associate with you is that you are a phenomenally patient arguer of a lot of things that I agree with. So being your friend on Facebook is great fun.
Yes.
Because I get to see you bother to engage with people and bother to have learnt how to stay patient and never insult anyone. And you're constantly sort of humble and kind whilst passionately disagreeing with people.
I wouldn't say constantly. I do lose my patience. This is something that if you had seen me doing a show, you wouldn't know, because it's not really in the show. You know, my shows are not a meticulous deconstruction of political opinions I don't agree with. They're not that. They're whimsical cavalcades of loosely structured jokes that I like. But I try to affect a sort of holy fool perspective on politics. I try to be patient with people. It doesn't always work, and I lose my patience, and I definitely have got into slanging matches with people on many occasions. And I've limited myself now to trying to only have conversations with people with whom I share enough common ground. There's no point talking to a flat earther on that you don't know on the internet. You're wasting your time. Mm-hmm. But I will talk with a comedian about a question like free speech in comedy, and why I don't think it's in a crisis, because we share a common value about free speech in comedy. We, like most comedians, think that's a fairly good idea. So there's enough common ground for us to have a conversation about it. But I won't try and persuade you, if you're essentially a bad person, to stop being essentially a bad person, because it won't work.
And do you want to do more stuff like that on stage, given that you're on stage, your stage output, comedy is sort of all about self-expression. And I feel like that's quite a big part of your expression of yourself, as when I see it on social media.
Yeah.
Does it occur to you? I'm not trying to sort of force you into a position you don't want to be in. I'm just sort of interested in whether you would be interested in doing that.
Well, being right all the time isn't very funny, is it? So I don't think it's a useful skill. And also, I increasingly realise that being right doesn't matter. As we increasingly exist in a world where facts are mild inconveniences at best. And I think there is a subtext in the stuff that I try and write, and it's been in the films that I try to make, and it's in the stand-up that I try and do, which is about the power of fantasy and whimsy and nonsense and imagination to undermine and escape and challenge the real world. Because I hate the concept, I hate the idea that escapism is sort of an abdication of our responsibility to deal with reality. I don't think it is that at all. I think sort of utopian fiction and fantasy fiction is a way of, it's a way of sort of doing thought experiments, sort of empathetic thought experiments that are really useful when it comes to thinking about the real world. And the value of nonsense for tackling all of the crushing misery of contemporary politics is, it's right there. What can we use to fight this? Well, we can use nonsense, because nonsense hurts authoritarian conservative strongmen. It's their kryptonite is silliness, I think, which is why I know it's hack to do jokes about Hitler, but I still regularly include Hitler in bits in spite of it being hack, because it gives me great joy to be very silly about a terrible person, to be very silly about, I don't know where I'm going.
No. I mean, this is a very, it's a very good point. I mean, the value of silliness is really, really important. And I love the idea that silliness is the kryptonite of authority. And seeing as the world appears to slide more and more into authoritarianism, then it's very optimistic, isn't it? It's a nice thing to think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying silliness. Yeah, I'm not saying whimsy is going to solve the problem, but it is, as a coping strategy, I think is extremely valid.
Yes.
And I resent my film school tutors who told me the only way to deal with things is social realism, documentary realism. It isn't. It's not the only fruit. You can do anything you want. What I found at film school was that nobody wanted to make the films that I was pitching, but I was good at pitching the films. And I would put jokes in the pitches because I was being quite cheeky. I knew that I wanted to do that. And I would do a 5-minute pitch for a 10-20 minute film, and then people would be unenthusiastic, but it would have had a great response in the room at the time. And I was baffled at the end of it why nobody wanted to make my film. And well, what I've realized was, like, you can work for, if you're making a student film or a short film, you can work for 6-9 months, you can work for longer on a 5-minute film. And only then do you find out whether it was a good idea or not. Whereas with stand-up, as we know, under normal circumstances, you can write something and you can try it out the same day. And so it's what I always find myself saying is it's a much cheaper medium to be unsuccessful in. But also, I think I've learned more about audiences from doing stand-up. I've learned more about their patience. I mean, this rambling podcast might not be the best example of that, but I've learned more about the rhythms of how you approach something by having an audience react to it in real time than I did from making films and then showing it to people after I've crafted it. But the interdimensional ABK animation, so at the start of the show, you can Google it and watch it. There's an intro.
I cannot recommend enough that people do that. It is delightful.
It's a Thundercats-esque introduction to the show. My tip, if you're considering doing something like that, would be to end the show with it, not start the show with it, because it makes it very difficult to follow if you do it well enough. But I started the show with it because I hadn't learned that at the time. But that was a weird sort of amalgam of the two, because the only way to find out if that was a good idea to do was to commit to doing it, which meant weeks of animating for an Edinburgh show, which is not a normal way of approaching an Edinburgh show. Mm-hmm. So it was incredibly hard work, but you can't just give people a you can't do an animatic or say, so I have this idea for the intro. Do you think that would be good? The only way of doing it is to just commit to it 100% and then afterwards find out if it was a good idea. And the nice thing that I've discovered so far is the more you do that and the more you commit to something, the more chance you have of it turning out to be a good idea.
Yes, that's almost one of the great rules of the internet. The internet seems to really value stuff that has clearly had a lot of time spent on it.
Yeah.
Do you think?
Yes, and I mean, it only got like 180 retweets, so it could have had more. but yes and no. I mean, there are wonderfully crafted podcasts out there that nobody hears, and then somebody will fall over in an amusing way and it'll go viral. So it's not like I think
sure,
there's justice in the
that's
world.
Fair. Yeah.
But one of the things that's really funny is wasting time. It's really funny, I think, for somebody to spend far too much time on an idea, to commit way too much to something, and for someone to squander their intellect and talent on something completely pointless is a hilarious thing.
That's true. That's
very entertaining.
If you look in terms of like Mel Brooks's thing about if I fall down a hole, that's a tragedy. but if you fall down a hole and die, that's comedy. Yeah, you know what I mean? It's something along those lines of paraphrasing. But yes, almost like even worse than falling down a hole is having spent months on something. That's like that's a completely universally relatable version of falling down a hole. So maybe it is imbued, something that has taken a lot of time for the purposes of comedy is imbued with tragedy.
Yeah, yes, it's the frivolousness and the squandering of
the most valuable resource anyone has.
Yeah,
yeah.
I've heard people say about, you know, like Python or Bill Bailey, the fact that Bill Bailey is obviously an extremely talented musician. He could be doing something else with those skills. He could be doing something quote unquote worthwhile, but he's not. He's doing this, and it's great. Python, you know, they could be being the lawyers and the doctors they trained to be. But they're arsing about. And I like that. That's part of the enjoyment.
So talk to me just briefly about the process of creating the opening credits for the Interdimensional ABK, because it is like, it's almost like, you know, when filters came in for a few years ago, that'll date us. If anyone's listening 10 years from now, oh, do you remember filters? But there was, when people first started doing filters that could make something look like a sort of bleached 70s Polaroid.
Yeah.
And like, is there a button you pressed that made that look exactly like the style of the opening credits of a mid 80s Japanese movie?
No, the button is being a genius and knowing how to do it. That was a little arrogant. But
No.
Maybe cut that out.
In this case, I urge anyone listening to this, immediately track it down and watch it on YouTube, and you will see there's no hyperbole here. I think it is a piece of genius, because making it look like, I watched it thinking, what is this? Who has he got to make this for him? How, oh my God, it's him. It's about him, and it's funny, and it's got jokes in it, and it's like, but it is still completely the thing. I think it's a masterpiece.
One of the things that I think I am good at, if I can say that without self-deprecation kicking in.
Well, it's fine. I'm leaving in the genius bit now, so we all know what you really think of yourself.
One of the things I'm good at is looking at things and seeing how they are put together. I'm good at pastiche. If I read something that's written in a particular style, I can write in that style. If I see something that is shot in a particular way, I can shoot in that way. And because I'm interested in how things are put together. And so I'm interested in how those animations were put together. So I scrutinized them, and I used software that is as similar to the way the Japanese animators would have been animating as possible. There are all kinds of cheats you can use in computer animation to make things faster. And I avoided those cheats most of the time So it's split up into cells as it would have been in the 80s. You know, people would have been inking and painting on cells of acetate. I'm doing it in a computer, but I'm still layering those cells on top of each other. I'm still adding a very slight shadow to those cells, because the cells sometimes cast a shadow. Mm. I'm still adding a little bit of wobble, because the cells are being, you know, like when the shoulders are staying still, but the head is moving, the head is being replaced, or the mouth is being replaced. So there's a little bit of wobble, so that these are things that are too subtle for anybody to actually notice them. But when they're not there, you can tell that they're not there. And as soon as they are there, it just looks like the thing that it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
There are cheats and compromises. You know, I made it widescreen and not 4:3. So it wasn't a complete commitment to reproducing the Thundercats style of animation. But I also worked with Lawrence Owen, who did the music. And he has that ability, but for music. So he can listen to how the music is constructed, and he can reconstruct it with the same sort of overdriven, distorted guitar sounds that those theme tunes had, that I know nothing about because I don't understand music. But he has that. He has an ear that can hear how things are put together.
And who did the not the lyrics, but the melody and the shape of the lyrics?
So I wrote the lyrics, and he wrote the melody.
Okay,
so that's sort of probably because more
that's
him
the
than me.
Perfect fusion of your comedy and the shape of, you know, it's your words and the shape of the eyes of a human, walk of a human man's walk, or whatever it is.
Yeah, I have listened to it so many times, but I don't think
legs of a human, a human man's walk. I'm not sure. Anyway,
heart of a tiger, heart of a tiger, and eyes of a hawk, legs of a human man's walk is the
first
line. Yes,
like that, it's just, it's just perfect.
that's me demonstrating my ability to write in pastiche, but much more it's Lawrence's ability to make it sound like how those things sound. So he didn't, the rhythm I was imagining it would have, I think I wrote it to the rhythm of, to like the meter of Ulysses 31 theme tune.
Yes, the meter.
Which is
obviously the
other reference.
Of course.
Because I look a bit like Ulysses 31. but he changed it completely to something much better than I was imagining.
So was that your Team America World Police, whereby you did something, devoted your time to it, it came out perfect, and you decided, I'm never doing that again because that was so much work?
No, it was way too much work. Yeah, I can't do an animated intro for every show. And I'm not sure I would want to try and do exactly that again, because probably it would feel like retreading the same. I feel like I probably wouldn't do it as well if I tried to do it again.
Sure, but in terms,
because now I know whether it's a good idea or not. So the experiment part of it, the fun of, am I doing something really stupid here? The fun of investing all that time in a risky time sink wouldn't be there, because now I know, that would work well in a show. So now it would be a calculated decision, and that isn't fun in the same way.
So is there, have you had any ideas which are even more heroic in terms of the enormous time they would take? What have you got on the back burner, which is like, oh man, next time there's a global pandemic and I get 6 months, I'm going to do this?
I thought I'll just do puppets in the next show, and started to make a puppet. And so I was halfway through making a puppet of a raven when COVID hit. And so now all I have is a half-finished raven puppet, which I'm not sure is going to pay off in the same way, but it has certainly been finding out how the mechanics of a sort of a mechanical beak work has been at least as pointless a time sink, but I don't know whether it's going to pay off. But that's what makes it a genuine risk. The sort of the ideal thing is a thing that everybody thinks is obscure.
Everybody knows.
So everybody thinks, I wonder if anyone else got that. That's ideal. Yeah. That's the golden mean, or whatever it is. That's the perfect. You want to be on the cusp of obscurity, which is very much where my career has always
good title,
been.
Hell of a title for an ABK show.
But that's where I'm already visualizing the artwork, astrological charts, and me with like a sextant. Anyway, not important. Listeners, a sextant is a
Everyone knows what a sextant is.
Everybody thinks that they're the only person who knows what a sextant is. But I would never rely on the word sextant in a punchline, but I would definitely have it there in a setup. Mm-hmm. Or I would have another word in the punchline that told you what a sextant was without you thinking I was telling you what the sextant was. That's what I would do. What was I saying?
I don't remember. Yeah, no. It was good.
I think that's it. Yeah, that's what's really enjoyable. Everybody bonding around something that seems obscure and that we didn't realize we knew, because it isn't just sort of the War Games crowd and the Warhammer fans and the nerds and the hippies and the people with dyed hair and facial piercings.
I have seen War Games multiple times, and I did used to play Warhammer, and I'm seeing now why I kind of got picked up in the rolling katamari that is your
I never played Warhammer. Yeah, don't like Lord of the Rings either. I'm an enigma.
You're a man full of contradictions.
I know.
Why didn't you like Lord of the Rings? A little bit too close to home.
I regularly get sort of that was very good from bald middle aged men bald red faced middle aged men who, if they are in the front row, terrify me because I know that they're going to be hard to win over.
Yeah.
And I do win them over because I can do that, and that is as much fun as making a show for all of the nerds. I love the little nerdlings. I love gathering a crowd of people, but I've done two solo shows at the Edinburgh Fringe, and I've done fairly good numbers on both of those shows. You know, the audience numbers have been decent, decent to good. I can't complain, but it's not like I have it's not like I'm aware of having a fan base, or I know there are people who come back and see me, but I can't tell you who it is that comes to see my shows. Anyone can come and see my show. It's for any, yes. It's really for anyone.
Yes.
It really, I mean, it's mostly white people, if I'm being honest.
But it is. It's white nonsense, isn't it?
It is white nonsense. Yeah. I did nearly call a show Sensible Jokes for White People, but I pulled back from that.
Oh, that would have been a really fun risk. I would have been fascinated to see what happened with that. There is something about you that as soon as you were booked for that preview at Chops and I knew the gang who were going to be there for it, I thought, this is going to go down great. And that made me think, oh, yeah. Like, I came away from that experience thinking, I can now start to see other types of acts who are wildly different to you but have the same amount of, I don't know what the word is, internetness, you know, I pronounced that badly.
Extremely onlineness.
Internetness. Maybe like a Suze Kempner. Like, yeah. Suze Kempner's audience are going to dig you. Not necessarily the same people, but the same sorts of people. They're a bit internet-y, they're a bit computer gamesy. They are excited to know about, say, Warhammer. That's not quite the right thing, but those sorts of things, they're excited to know about those rather than secretly ashamed of knowing about those things.
Yes, yeah. And often the secret is that the references aren't, I'm not going to do any specific references to anything in Warhammer, but I'm going to reference the aesthetic of Warhammer.
Yes.
Which you don't need to know anything about Warhammer to get. You go, oh, it's that sort of Lord of the Ringsy.
Yes,
stuff.
Gotcha.
One piece of advice I had from a film tutor at film school, which I think was really good. Not to imply that all the rest of the advice was bad, much of it was good. I have no resentment. So much resentment! But one really good piece of advice was, you have an idea for a film and you're not sure if people are going to be interested, forget about that. Because if you're interested in a subject, then other people will be interested in a subject. Because, like, the world's massive. Like, if you're really interested in anything, someone else is too. But also, your enthusiasm for it is engaging. So the trying to work out what people want, I think, is a waste of time. I have no idea how you build an audience. But what I do know is that when I put my stuff that I'm interested in front of a crowd who have not been selected, a crowd of ordinary people, a lot of them enjoy it. It is mainstream and accessible. Or I've made it mainstream and accessible. It's not that weird. There is an audience for it. The challenge is reaching that audience, which is very difficult because I don't control the gateways. I'm not a gatekeeper. I don't have access to all of the channels of distribution of information. But when people do see something I've done, they usually like it.
Pope Lonergan, friend of the show, says, how do you / would you deal with a really aggressive heckler?
I don't know how badly I've been heckled. I've definitely, yeah. I'm not that bad at it. I'm not that bad at dealing with someone who's ruining the show.
Do you have certain go-tos? Do you have certain strategies or gags? Oh, right, okay.
I don't have any stock lines or strategies, except the strategy of not changing my persona. So I stay nice and polite. Mm-hmm. In the face, but I might veer towards passive aggressive on occasion. I think it worked. I'm fairly good at being quick off the cuff. I'm fairly good at making them. I don't know how I do this because I'm not very good at it at other times in life. But when I'm on stage, if it's going well, I can do it. I can get a laugh out of what I say in response to them, and that usually works. Like, Not responding aggressively to them usually de-escalates the situation. Mm-hmm. Not that I invite that many aggressive hecklers. I'm not a brutal alpha male presence on stage.
Oh, you're not? I've misunderstood this whole interview.
Just dropping some truth bombs about the differences between men and women, Stuart. That's my style. You say I can't smoke indoors? I'll smoke indoors. I'll smoke 9 cigarettes. Who's going to stop me? The PC police.
Ali Gibson says, your comedy is incredibly diverse, from musical jokes to physical acting out, models and storytelling. Is this from reluctance?
Not ethnically. I realise
it's diversified, I think is what we're saying.
Yeah. Your extremely white comedy is very diverse. Please explain.
Is this from a reluctance to settle into a style, or just all the things you enjoy?
It's just all the things I enjoy. I'm not aware of it, of me veering wildly between performance styles. I don't think I have a huge range as a performer. I look like a sort of wizard come Jesus hippie. Like that, I can't be lots of different things. I can't be bombastic or indignant or angry or threatening or sexy. I'm imagining you in a leather jacket
and it's quite tough.
Bombastic, the bombastic and sexy ABK 2021. That's the show. But I can't be any of those things because I'm not those things. I'm never sexy in real life. I am angry, but it isn't very funny. And it's just, I'm trying to do the stuff that I would have wanted to see when I was 14. Like, I loved it whenever, you know, I liked things like Josie Long or Reeves and Mortimer, where the rules of what it was weren't clear. So I didn't know that you weren't allowed to bring out a thing and read it or have a mask or go into a sketch. And that's what I liked. You know, I don't have any enthusiasm for the purity of just a man and a microphone. That's what's great about stand-up, isn't it, Stu? It's just a man and a microphone. It's always a man telling you his correct beliefs. It's fine. If you can make a show with just that, fair play. Set yourself away. I'm not bothered. But I like it when people have got props or things they prepared or a song or an image or a slideshow or something else. Because why not? Because if you can do it, if you can talk about it, why wouldn't you? If you're interested in it, why wouldn't you talk about it?
Great answer. Thank you. John Rivett says, please tell us, how do we get onto the A timeline? Less of a question than a callback.
That is more of a callback than a question. We can't. We're stuck here. We just have to make the best of it. That is the essence of the show.
Eddie Hurst says, do you see a creative difference between live work and social media content, or is it the same approach in a different medium?
I've got better at doing social media post Edinburgh. I've done a few tweets that have done okay, and I've got some more followers. Still not. We're not talking Suze Kempner numbers, but okay. And I think it's the style of performance is different. Talking to a camera is different to talking to an audience. I find it harder than talking to an audience. It's much more intimidating. The fewer people I'm talking to, the more intimidating I think it is, because it becomes more like a social interaction.
Yep.
Whereas talking to a crowd is quite relaxing. Wow, listen to my questioning intonation going up at the end of every sentence. Are you a little bit insecure about this, ABK? Yes, I am. But the nice thing about social media is I can do videos, and so I can use other skills that I have to be able to do things in my video that other people aren't doing in their video, just in small ways. If I'm going to do a spoof, I can do a spoof that looks slightly more convincing than someone else's spoof would look. Which what that means is that I get lots of lovely lighting comments on my comedy clips, which is just the absolute worst. Nothing is worse than someone complimenting the lighting in a stand-up clip.
Paul Savage says, what's the logical endpoint for your character that's not live work?
Thanks, Paul. That feels a little undermining. I don't know. I don't think ABK gets a sitcom. Because it's just me. So I don't think that I have.
You might sitcom, but you might get. I think ABK could get the interdimensional ABK, the show, a sort of quasi.
You might say that, but
Doctor
Radio
Who.
4 did not agree, so it didn't happen.
Yeah, but
bloody,
you know,
Radio 4.
That's a gatekeeper issue, isn't it?
Bloody.
You've got to just make stuff.
I've got two surnames. How am I not on Radio 4? How have I not been on Radio 4?
I could completely
didn't go to bloody Cambridge, that's why.
I could completely visualise a a sort of riff on Doctor Who type, a series of shorts at least.
Yeah.
Some, you know, what you need to do is make some massively viral short video content of you in the world going and interacting with stuff that then people get excited about and turn into a sitcom. Surely that's the game plan, yeah, isn't it?
I think there's two things, because I like scripted comedy. But I don't seem, I'm not trying to write stuff for me to be the main character, which is sort of a lot of stuff at the moment that's being commissioned is personality driven. I want to be just the supporting weird hippie character,
yep,
and for someone else to be the main character, because someone with proper acting chops to be the main character, while mm-hmm. I can do what's within my range, which mm-hmm. is this. That's what I want. It may not be what the channels are asking for, but I'm going to keep pushing it towards them until they relent. On the other hand, there's like, I really liked Mark Steele's lectures, and I'm glad that like the comedy lecture thing came out on Comedy Central, because I don't understand why that isn't a main genre of stuff. Mm-hmm. Comedians talking about real serious things, but in a funny way, mm-hmm. because that is something I think I'd be excellent at, sort of doing funny documentaries or exploring a concept. Like I've long wanted to explain do the history of Western philosophy, like Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy, but with jokes. To go, okay, well, here's... but I don't know enough about it, because I'm not a trained philosopher, but to say, okay, well, here's Spinoza, here's some gags about Spinoza, here's me talking about Spinoza, but in a funny way, so it's funny and educational at the same time. That, I think, fits with the way I am on stage and would be of some interest and benefit to people, even if I've made it sound even less commercial than my current stand-up.
If you had, final question, this is my own one. If you had one quality that got you where you are other than your comic ability, what would it be?
I didn't stop doing it, I think. I've got, you know, film school friends who, and, you know, film school contemporaries who've like literally been like won the Palme d'Or. Somebody who went to my film school after me won the Palme d'Or, mm-hmm. And I have not won the Palme d'Or. I have won the Leicester Mercury Stand-Up of the Year award, but in the amount of time since then and now, Ramesh Ranganathan was already on TV and I am not on TV, so take that with a pinch of salt. But the main characteristic that people who succeed have, in fact, the only imitable characteristic of people who succeed, is having continued to try and do something. Now, I stopped trying to make short films, and it's very unsurprising that I haven't made an award-winning short film mm-hmm. between then and now. And that, I think, is quite instructive, because by continuing to do comedy in one form or another, at the moment that's limited to online, but by continuing to do something, I'm infinitely more likely to be able to keep doing it than if I stop doing it. And I don't blame people who stop doing it, because it can be very difficult and it's very hard, and it's very hard to make a living out of it. And it's very hard to balance with other things like profitable work and kids and a family and a desire to live in more than one room in mm-hmm. London. Mm-hmm. But it's just that. The easiest thing to imitate, the easiest quality of successful people to imitate is not stopping doing it, continuing to try. Because everything else, all the other stuff, I think is a bit, oh, well, they did this in their career and they made this choice at that time. Well, it doesn't work. It's like when my parents' generation give me people of my generation advice about getting a job. I remember Dad saying to my partner, you want to print your CV out on good quality paper. It's like, well, that's useless advice. It was good advice, but mm-hmm. now not only do you have to submit your CV, you have to then break down the same information into a form with incredible difficulty so that you can save somebody else time. Mm-hmm. And there's no opportunity to impress in that sort of way. That is useless advice. And I think I heard a comedian probably on this podcast say something like, if you're not making money out of stand-up after 6 months, if you're not getting paid gigs, quit. And I don't believe that that applies to if you are starting now, because that person started in the 1980s when there were 9 comedians and 400 gigs.
Yeah.
If you are not making money after 6 months of starting now, I'm not surprised. Mm-hmm. Don't stop. You know, don't stop. That advice isn't good advice. You can't follow that advice, because those people were the economy was different and the media landscape was different. What you can imitate, though, is that they kept trying to do stuff. They kept making things. They kept having ideas. Is that all right?
Mate, I feel fantastic.
I've been so nervous about this. I hope it hasn't come across too much. I've been trying not to be a downer on it. But the prospect of recording it really, having spoken about how on the level I am in terms of mental health, it really hit me for a loop. The realization that I'm not doing stand-up now. I've never felt like less of a comedian.
Yes.
Than I am at the moment because I'm hardly doing it.
Yeah.
The government have banned me from doing it. Not specifically, but it feels personal. And just the roaring inadequacy and roaring... I don't know if you can call it imposter syndrome. What if you're not actually good? Is it still imposter syndrome if you're bad?
Well, that we didn't really get into that aspect of it. Like, I didn't ask you if you were happy because I know you'd said, oh, you know, no major childhood traumas and stuff. And we talked a bit about resilience and kind of feeling sad about it. Do you is imposter syndrome a thing for you? Because I know, and I'm so sorry, I had to move the timing of this and I had to fanny around. And you know, when people
you
do that,
tortured
to
me with 2 weeks.
I really did. I really did, and I'm sorry. Because I wasn't surprised to hear that you were nervous about doing it. I wasn't expecting you to be, but I wasn't surprised. But we didn't really talk much about that aspect of it. Like, is that a thing that holds you back, like the fear of being an imposter, or is it simply just ever present?
Yeah, definitely. I am happy. In answer to the stock ConCon Pod question, are you happy? Yes, I'm one of the happy people, which I guess makes me a golfer, even though I flipping hate golf. I can't stand golf. Oh, I hate it so much.
I mean, it's not that joining in a sport, is it?
No, that's true. Yeah. No, I hate all the other sports as well, but flipping golf. I am one of the happy people. I've got a supportive family. My dad, who only likes working class comedians, likes my stand up, even though it's middle class stand up. And I know he's biased, but I was certain he wouldn't like it, but he does like it. So I have my dad's approval and really should stop comedy at this point because there's nothing else you need to achieve as a comedian, is there? And I'm in a stable relationship with the same person I've been in a stable relationship for a very long time. Who's a woman. I don't mean to use partner to imply that I'm on the LGBTQ spectrum. But yeah, I have the constantly oscillating self-confidence between extraordinary arrogance and despairing inadequacy. Constantly, from moment to moment, and while working on stuff, and during shows. That's the reason that thrill of being introduced as a comedian is nice, because it, for a moment, erases that sense of inadequacy. It's a reminder that, actually, I can do this. You know, in some circumstances, I could be said to be a comedian. And that is nice. I really, really like that. But coming on this show really triggered a sense of how do I deserve to be claiming to be a comedian? Why do I deserve to be on here?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm in the sense of I see that as opposed to yeah.
No. But it is a barrier to it is a mental barrier to doing things because so many times I have not taken a risk because you play things out in your head, don't you? You go, oh, well, there's no point asking this person that question because they're just going to say no, so I won't even ask.
Yeah.
And that's the opposite of the don't quit philosophy.
Mm.
It's the opposite of the don't quit mantra. If you don't ask, then you don't get. Shy burns, get knee broth, as they say, down our way. The ideal situation would be to be one of those people who's completely deludedly self-confident, but also talented. I think that would be ideal.
If you could inject something Matrix style, then if not talent, massive confidence.
Yes,
probably be
yes,
enough.
Because you can work on the other stuff. Yeah, you can work on your writing.
Yeah,
but you can't work on your confidence. A lot of people will sort of say, you know, about another comedian. They'll say things like, oh, he thinks he's a bit good, doesn't he? Or she's a bit arrogant, you know, a bit, oh, they overestimate how funny they are. And I feel very intimidated by that kind of confidence, but also envious of it. Because I think, well, I can't resent that. Because if you've got that conviction, good for you. That's a key ingredient. You're already off to a great start if you have that sense that you deserve to be there. You deserve to make it, whatever that means. But I don't have that sense of deserving.
I mean, we can't leave it there. That's too down an ending, but it was very final. I really empathize with that. I've become aware in the last few years that one of my biggest challenges is I don't dream big enough. And I think that's because it's that sense of playing things out in your head, assuming the worst, and absolutely minute to minute kind of chronic anxiety of just going, this is going to be fine, this is going to be amazing, to, oh my God, what am I playing at in the space of moments? Very hard to deal with. Do you have any kind of mantras or ways of resolving it? Do you have a thing you think to yourself on stage if you catch yourself in that?
I think it is just trying to look at myself through the 14-year-old me who just discovered stand-up's eyes and realize not only am I doing stand-up, I'm doing exactly the kind of stand-up I really like.
So that was Alistair Beckett King, a joy to talk to him. I have a spring in my step because this morning I recorded a fresh interview for you with Martin Moore, a.k.a. Martin Big Pig, a fantastic circus and stand-up and cabaret performer and now mentor and teacher as well. That'll be coming to you soon. I suspect we'll do Colt Cabana next week because that's been burning a hole in my hard drive for a little while. Remember, extras, 20 minutes of extra content with ABK available at comedianscomedian.com/insiders and to you immediately if you're already in the Insiders Club, where you can also get advert free episodes on your secret and private feed access to the Slack workspace where we can all hang out with our purely metaphorical and not actual wangs out. So with that in mind, I'm going to zip off. Will I post Amble? I always decide not to and then end up doing it. So let's just do the thank yous. Thanks to Nathan Wood for editing the show, Jake Crossland for logging. Music was by Rob Smouten, and Peter Dobbing is your podcast consultant as ever. Get in touch at comedianscomedian.com to find out more about the podcast, comedyinsights.com to find out more about all me clever clogs presentation, speaking, resilience business. A huge thank you to Sophie at Lego, for whom I did one of those talks recently, and I was sent a little thank you thing, a little corporate hospitality thing of some Lego. And I tell you what, I don't really get sent free things. I'm not really at that level of fame or reach or notoriety or whatever it is you need to do in order to be one of those comics that you go, oh, I like your trainers, and they go, yeah, I get them free from XYZ Company because I'm a famous comedy guy. But I tell you what, I'd happily swerve all the free trainers in the world to be sent free surprise Lego through the post. So thank you once again, Sophie, and all the people at Lego and the Lego people themselves. Do you regard yourself as a Lego person if you work at Lego? I would think of nothing finer. Maybe it gets old after a while, but I would say for the first 8 years I hypothetically worked at Lego, I wouldn't tire of describing myself as a Lego person. Oh, great. And I would also invest in some removable legs, just to complete the image. That's all. I've arguably got 12 minutes now whereby I can post amble at you. Should I use it? I'm trying to clear my desk pre-half term. Because half term is now a thing in my life. Let's talk about that. That'll be the post-amble. That's the episode. But hang around and I'll speak to you in a second. Bye for now. And if you're hanging around, hello again. Half term is now a thing in my life. I said this to a friend recently. He said, how's everyone? And I was like, well, I'm all giddy because half term's coming up. And half term hasn't been a thing for me for 20 years, but now it is because the boy, Boutros, has started school and this is his first half term coming up. So every time I say, it's going to be a holiday next week, he goes, no, Daddy, it's not a holiday, it's half term. And he's very proud to know the technical terms. But what a joyful thing Hey, this is what I'll briefly mention. You know Sarah Baron, brilliant comic Sarah Baron's been on this podcast. And I mean, she's done other stuff as well, but let's frame her within the ComCom extended universe. She was our guest. She was mine and Sindhu's guest for the final episode in this series of Child Labour, which you can find at childlabourpod.com or wherever else you know where podcasts are found. Find it there. Sarah Baron was wonderful, just wonderful. I said something unguarded and celebratory about having two children in the first 10 minutes of that episode, and she kind of went to bits because of her not challenges, but her kind of dilemma as to whether to have a second child or stick at one and all of the attendant issues. And it was to hear someone so fast and articulate and meaningful. Everything she says, she really sort of qualifies and imbues with meaning and makes sure that you're understanding precisely what she means, but she does it in a very fast and witty and sharp kind of a way. To hear the combination of that and kind of the dam bursting on this emotional stuff she had been holding on to at the beginning part of that conversation was really special. And my enormous thanks, mine and Cindy's thanks to her. If you have yet to catch up with Child Labour, thank you for all the damn it, let's call it fan mail that's come in as a result of that. It's been a great joy to have that other string to my bow, and I hope we go on to do more series of those. But yes, where was I? Half term. Some of you are now in lockdown again, for fuck's sake. More power to your elbow, all of you who are now having to cancel all your gigs at the weekend or cancel gigs you were going to go and see because you're in the Northwest or in other bits of the country or the world, which suddenly find yourself under lockdown again. I don't know what to say. We're all right. I'm in Bristol. We're okay at the moment. And my feelings about the whole thing have kind of... They've sort of, they're not switched, but they've kind of refined from, oh my God, that virus is on every surface, to, oh, well, I'm happy to do my bit by not going out much and all that stuff. I'm great. I'm grateful for the opportunity to do my bit. I know people now are sort of, if I say coming out of the woodwork, I hope that doesn't mean I imagine them as woodworms or any kind of worms, but people seem to be changing their minds now, and a lot of people are feeling emboldened to go, do you know what? This is all shit. We should just carry on living and devil take the hindmost. I'm absolutely not one of them. I suppose I'm just trying to maintain my own unique brand of kindness without having to do too much reading. But it does seem to me that, you never want to find yourself defending the government, let alone the fucking Tories. I sent my brother a meme I had stumbled upon of that, the Fatima cyber thing that's been flying around. And it was a meme that someone had constructed of Jean-Luc Picard not knowing his next role was going to be in cyber. My brother texted back something along the lines of, incredible, isn't it? Fuck them, brackets, the Tories, not the Borg. So I think you can tell where our political sensibilities lie. And I'm certainly not defending them, but I do think that we are... Fucking hell, it's a terrifying, unknown, uncharted time. And if you... All I'm saying is, if you are... I mean... This is... Do you know what? Having said, you never want to find yourself defending the government, I'm absolutely not defending the government. But I do think anybody in charge at the moment would be having a nightmare. Because it is so uncharted. And the thing I keep coming back to, let's talk about this. The thing I keep coming back to is very early doors in the pandemic. I saw some photos on imgur.com, huge fan of IMGUR. I believe it's pronounced imgur.com. I saw some photos of people wearing masks during Spanish flu, like black and white photos of loads of people just getting on with wearing masks. And I think seeing that made me feel a lot more compliant about the whole mask thing. So all I'm saying is that I am interested to see various people I know exploding with rage on social media and saying, not, oh my God, how can we be helping people more efficiently and better? But instead, oh, for fuck's sake, why have I got to wear a mask? My feeling is if they could wear them in the 1900s, so can you. You've got better ones now. They're lighter. they're more cleanable and things like that, or washable. So I don't know. grow up is what I'm saying. And if you feel that applies to you, then yes, it does. And if you're cross that applies to you, then no, it doesn't. As you were, do whatever you want. I don't fucking care. But I'm going to keep wearing one. And I hope that you are all managing to experience a certain amount of hope and optimism in whatever stage of all of this shit that you are currently in. Let's get to the A timeline as soon as we can, all right? Bye for now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.